Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith Incorporated, member SIPC.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Tom Keene, as I mentioned, in Boston last night at Fenway Park, a frozen Fenway Park, I should add, where Bentley defeated Army for the second year in a row. You were there, Tom. An eventful second period.
He put out a graph of the plot of the puck as it made its way around the rink.
John Tucker,
what was great
good.
About it? That was very good, John. What was great about it, as we saw with Detroit and Toronto in that fabulous NHL game in Toronto the other day, is there's no substitute, David Gura, for outdoor hockey. It's just different. The ice is harder. Everything is faster. Everything moves faster. And if it's some guy making $7 million for the Toronto Maple Leafs, or it's some kid worried about the organic chemistry exam at Bentley University this coming Thursday, they're both the same. They got smiles on their faces, even within the heat of the game. I will say this. There's something, and you know, John Tucker and David Gura know this, but for our international audience, it's the Sistine Chapel of baseball, is the way I put it. Remarkably unchanged from my childhood. And then to see a hockey game stretch from third base to first base, David, it was just extraordinary.
You weren't calling the game, but you were providing color, as you often do, Tom. How was it? How was it being in the favorite chair you were so looking forward to sitting in?
I'm sitting in Joe Castiglione's chair, the giant of Red Sox radio. And I made a joke. I did not go back and forth with Ken Danico of the New Jersey Devils. I am in awe of what Mr. Micheletti and Mr. Danico do in New York as color commentators. It is, John Tucker, it is so darn hard to come off a play and say something intelligent about what just happened. It looks easy. We all sit at home.
You did not disappoint, though.
Paul McNamara is joining me. Grizzled Pro does Harvard hockey up here in Boston. At one point, Johnny spit out his coffee. I was so inept. It froze on the way down to the desk, I might point out. But it was a struggle, to say the least.
How was the crowd, Tom?
You know, I'm glad you bring that up. 34,000 seats in the traditional Red Sox. There's a little more attendance now. Seats on the Green Monster out of the left field. And they're building new seats, actually, for this year to pay for all their high-priced talent. I would suggest 3,000 people towards one end of the rink, the third base side of Fenway Park. But it was a joyous crowd. Many people, of course, from Bentley, which is based out of greater Boston. But it was quite something to see Army attend as well. And it was just a joyous crowd with Bentley. Surprising. Army's a better hockey team. And Bentley just put the spirit into it and really just decisively beat them over 1, 2, and 3 periods.
There you go again. 3-1 the final score there. Just want to break the India GDP figures crossing the Bloomberg right now. The expectation, the estimate there was for 6.8% growth. In fact, GDP growth at 7.1% for the year ending in March. So some news there about the Indian economy, Tom.
Yeah, it has been an odd first week. We've been honored with all the guests that we've had on Bloomberg Radio and Bloomberg Television for Surveillance starting off the year. But the backdrop, and David, my theme has been the butterflies and the butterfly effect. That is a pretty ancient concept, nothing new. But the real concept of it is the idea from MIT and Edward Lorenz 50 years ago of if Mr. Trump says something, the wings flap in Kuala Lumpur. And we continue to see this on this Friday morning.
Absolutely. And I know you've been looking at emerging markets, looking at the Turkish lira as well throughout the morning. That's still your focus. That's been your focus through the week, your emerging market currencies.
It has been. The EM in Turkey with all their politics as well. It is a pleasure to speak to the mayor, Mayor Walsh. For years, it has been Mayor Menino. And Marty Walsh, whatever anyone would say, his supporters, his critics, what large shoes he had to fill, and he has done it with a wonderful grace. Mayor Walsh, good morning. What was it like the first day filling the shoes of Tom Menino?
Well, you know, the first walking in, I wasn't sure what to expect. I think the one thing that was not expected was people in Boston, not that they were looking for a change, but they were kind of curious on what life would be without a Mayor Menino. And I think that helped in a way, the fact that he did so many great things in his 20 years as mayor of the city. And people, you know, a lot of young people only grew up with Mayor Menino. They didn't know anyone else. They didn't know there was a Kevin White. They didn't know there was a Ray Flynn. So it was kind of it was a nice transition because people gave the leeway to see, well, what's going to be different? And I think people like what they've seen in 3 years here.
Oh, I would agree with that. I mentioned last night to Gloria Larson of Bentley University this idea of courage, the courage of Tip O'Neill, Joe Moakley, selected. There's like four, Marty, help me, there's like four Republicans in Boston, or is it, are they up to six?
Three and a half, maybe.
That's when Mitt Romney's in town. Mayor, when I look at the courage of Boston to do the big dig, big projects, big vision, the payoff is General Electric choosing to come to Boston. Give us an update on the entrepreneurial momentum, the fancy guys, the elites, the service sector dynamism of this city. Give us an update after that big win with General Electric.
You know, even before GE came to Boston, you know, innovation and you know, obviously we have medical here because of the hospitals that we have. But GE really, to sum it up, Jeff Immelt, when he came here, talked about the political atmosphere in Boston. He liked how it was going. He loved the talent that we have in our city with the college students. About 250,000 college students every school year come here, some from Boston, some from all over the country, all over the world, quite honestly. He talked about that talent. He talked about the culture of our city. He spoke about the beauty of what's happening in Boston that you can get from one side of the city to the other. He actually walking around, and we have all the amenities that big cities in America have. And then we also have the innovation and technology is just incredible. You know, we have Mass Challenge here. We have WeWork here. We have so much biotech and tech.
Right.
And it's really, you know what's happening? A lot of it is going down to the South Boston waterfront. But a lot of it also settling in the downtown area, so it's kind of, it's the economy of the future that Boston's really building upon. And GE in our city is just an incredible victory for the city. But it's also good for GE. You know, it's not just a one way relationship. GE gets a lot of benefits, particularly with the education here in the city.
I want to jump in here, Mayor Walsh. David Gurr, I want you to jump in with the mayor, but I want to point out, folks, this is important. With the medical excellence of this city, you get that if you're a kid with cancer and you have to utilize the facilities of the Boston medical community, and that's what Marty Walsh did a million years ago. David?
You called it a victory there, Mayor Walsh, and I know that it was competitive. It's hard to get these companies to come to your city, to go to any city. How fiercely competitive was it? How hard is it for you to compete for other companies, and are you going to roll out the carpet in the same way you did for GE for other companies going forward?
Well, I think what was key here is that the state and the city came together as one team. There was no ego. There was no who gets the credit. It was the state, which is, you know, the governor, Charlie Baker, myself, and our teams really worked very closely together. And the business community came into it a little bit, and so did some of the higher education facilities. So I think if companies are looking, they're looking for stability. They're not looking for risks in government. They're not looking for headaches. I don't think every company that you bring to a city, you need to, quite honestly, put a tax incentive together. You shouldn't need to do that because you can't afford it over the long run. Or at least short run, you kind of, you don't want to say you bankrupt the city, but you put the city at a competitive disadvantage because it is about growth. It is about revenue. It's about getting real estate tax and income tax to the city to generate some of the ability things you have to do. Yeah. But I think you have to have that team approach. You see it in sports all the time. The teams that win the championships are the ones with offense and defense and special teams or whatever it might be come together.
Well,
and that's what happened in this particular case.
Tom Keene in Boston, David Gurr in New York, Jobs Day. But with us now, the 54th mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh. And, of course, Marty Walsh comes to us on the Spectrum Enterprise phone line, Spectrum Enterprise nationwide fiber-based network, and IT infrastructure solutions. Marty, you have a different view from most of the plutocracy. You are part of the Laborers Local 223. You were there as a kid, 21 years old. What's the view of our president-elect of Laborers Local 223? Did they turn out and vote for Donald Trump?
No, I would think that a lot of the building trades in Boston voted for Hillary Clinton. But I'm not going to kid myself. There's a large faction of members, not just of unions, but of a lot of different areas around the country that voted for Donald Trump. And I tried to say, I mean, I don't want to go right to the negatives on what his presidency is going to be. You know, there's some questions around some of the social programs that he has. I think people are unsure exactly what all this talk on bringing jobs back to America means and how can he do that. I think every president tries to do that. No president goes into office to say we want to export jobs. But it'd be interesting to see how does he bring these jobs back. And if they come back, are they going to be good paid jobs for workers, or are they going to try and, you know, get workers to work for minimum wage in some of these places?
Mayor Walsh, you've talked a lot about inequality as an issue in Boston, as an issue in the country. I looked at the Globe yesterday. Tom probably saw in hard copy. Rents are down in Boston, if only by 1.7% or $36 a month on average. How big an issue is this for you in Boston, and how do you as a mayor do something about it? It's something Tom and I talk a lot about in the context of New York, of course. How particular is the situation there in Boston?
No, it's a big issue, and I think what's happening is people are being pushed out of the city. Boston, New York, San Francisco, Chicago are expensive places to live. And what I'm doing in Boston is we launched a housing plan in 2014 to create 53,000 units of new housing by the year 2030. We're way ahead of our plan. We have about 40,000 units under construction in the permitting process or complete in Boston. And there's about 40% of those are moderate low-income housing units. And I think that what we're seeing a little bit in the drop in rent stabilization, I don't know if it's called stabilization, but we're starting to see, you know, getting more supply on the market. Mm-hmm. There's such a high demand in Boston right now. People moving in, our population is going to be at 700,000 people in the next 2 years, and we haven't seen that population since the 1950s. Yeah. So we're really, you know, a lot of people want to be here, but we have to continue to work on two things, I think, that we've done in the last couple of years. One is working on making sure we build more housing, and the second is we'll really focus on pay equity for women in the city. A lot of households are led, or female-led households. And we put out a report yesterday about a wage gap and working to try and close that wage gap. And people might not see that as one of the ways of closing income inequality, but it's a big way, particularly with 50% of the households are led by women.
Mayor, we spend most of our time worldwide and coast to coast talking to fancy guys with fancy degrees. You didn't take that path. You took a different path right from your childhood. What's your message to the plutocracy today? How everybody wants America to get together away from what many describe as a new gilded age. What's the Walsh prescription to get us away from the negative outcomes of a gilded age?
You know, America's a great country, and I'm a typical American story to some degree. In some way, I'm not. My mother and father came to this country from Ireland. I went to school at Boston College, but I went to school at night. I worked during the day, my family worked hard for it. It has, and they taught me how to work hard for what I have. And I still believe in the American dream, and I still think there is an American dream out there. And I think that as a society, you know, we're just going to continue to move forward. I'm not sure what the next 4 years are going to bring in this country. Certainly, I supported Hillary Clinton for president. Some people didn't think Hillary is the right person. Some people didn't think Donald's the right person. But at the end of the day, America is still the greatest country in the world. And we can continue to work hard. So people listening out there that are struggling, just keep moving forward. I mean, it's a day at a time. And that's my approach in life, is a day at a time. And America's going to continue to be the best country in the world because of its people.
He is the 54th mayor of Boston. His goal this year is to get David Ortiz to do one more.
Yeah.
Marty Walsh, thank you so much. He is the mayor of Boston. Bloomberg Surveillance this morning from New York, from Boston, this Jobs Day. David Gura in New York, I'm Tom Keene in Boston. And I might add that with all the worthies that we speak through the year in Davos and in London and New York, this is the most important interview of the year. We do it on January 6th because it's about your non-retirement account. Alicia Monell is with the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. It barely describes her contribution to thinking, analyzing, and checking the data of all of our miserable retirement programs. Professor Monell joins us in our Boston studios. Alicia, just honored to have you here. ERISA 1974, really going back to JFK in 1961. Almost everybody I know says this is a failure. How much of a failure is our work of 1974 that we're all living in 2017?
It was well-intentioned legislation to strengthen the traditional pension plan. It also made the pension plan very costly, and a lot of other things changed that made 401k plans much more attractive to employers and to employees at the time than the typical pension plan.
I remember reading one of your research pieces, and folks, go to the Center for Retirement Research website with just tons of research by people dead serious about where we are. A few years ago, you basically said 81% of Americans are not where they need to be for retirement. Give us an update. What's the vector? Are we doing better or is it worse?
So we put out something called the National Retirement Risk Index that measures the percent of households that are not going to be able to maintain their standard of living in retirement. And that number is in 2013 was 52%. And that's shocking. That's more than half the population that are at risk.
So what are
Sorry, David. So, I mean, and that's up substantially from the 90s.
That's up, and that's startling. What are the consequences of that? We were talking with Danny Blanchflower of Dartmouth earlier in the week about how much part-time work we're seeing and how much later people are working into their lives. Is that correlation there? Do you see that?
So I'm a big fan of working later. I was talking to Tom before the program.
Yes, we are, aren't we?
And I mean, I think that's actually a very good thing. That's very different than raising the Social Security full retirement age. But if people can stay in the labor force, they have a much higher probability of being secure in retirement.
How do you respond to the idea that those that have means should be able to put aside a lot more, because not only are they going to fund their own retirements, but they end up writing checks for a lot of family members? Why do we limit retirement contributions? Are we trying to get the rich people?
So there's a tax benefit associated with retirement savings. So to the extent the individual benefits, the Treasury...
Oh, but come on. I pay the taxes down the road when I'm 104.
Oh, but Tom, you know that deferral has a real benefit. And that puts the Treasury behind, and it's trying to target these incentives for people who really need to save. The notion is that super rich people can... almost don't need to save and make
yeah,
the decision.
My point on this, David, not that you would understand this young lad, the definition of super rich for me and Professor Monell is a lot different than the super rich of the Congress.
What's the notion of retirement today? I mean, do we regard retirement differently? Are we seeing a change in how we define what retirement is?
So you're right. Retirement's a relatively recent phenomena, and it's a 20th century phenomena. People are still going to be able to retire. The key to making the whole situation better, other than fixing the programs, and I'd like to talk about that for a second, too,
sure,
if I have a chance, it is to encourage people to stay in the labor force. And that means they have to plan ahead. They need to tell their employer they're not going to, you know, leave at 62 and they want to be included in training programs and they want to be considered for promotion, all that kind of thing. That comes from the employee. We also need to fix the 401k system so it works better. We need to fix Social Security because it has a deficit. And we need to expand coverage because if you take a snapshot of the workforce at any moment in time, half the population has no 401k, no defined benefit plan, nothing at all. So, I mean, we really need a three-part fix here.
Our colleague Carol Heimeritz wrote what I thought was a great piece about people working longer and the difficulty that... that comes up there, getting employers to go along with that. How do we finesse that? How do we make it something that's more widely acceptable?
So employers are skeptical of people with gray hair. I think that is
really
true. Yes.
Really? I'm shocked to hear that.
I think that's true. And so the employee really needs to develop this relationship with the employer, emphasizing how committed to the work they are. They can't spend time on the computer looking at property in Florida. This is employees need to persuade employers that they are going to be valuable well into their 60s.
If you're just joining us, Alicia Monell of Boston College, holding court at the Center for Retirement Research. She is the Drucker Professor of Management Sciences. What would Peter Drucker say of our totally messed up retirement plan? I mean, he was legendary.
He was.
And he would have been outspoken about the mess we're in.
I think he would. I think that he would say that there are enormous holes in this system. And the only way for people to be secure is to have those holes fixed.
So you have the voice of Democrats and, I believe, selective Republicans. When you bring Monell urgency to Washington, how do our elected officials respond?
I think it should be a non-apolitical issue, but it is not, in the sense that to make 401k plans work better, we need to make them automatic. That means people have to be automatically enrolled. They have to have a contribution rate that's reasonable when they're put in. They need some auto-escalation in the default contribution rate. And there's a resistance to, and all that stuff is encouraged under current law, but it's time, it's gone, the encouragement has gone as far as it can. At this point, it's time to say, if you want to have a 401k plan, you have to make it automatic. And that's the only way the 401k plans are going to work.
We haven't talked, go ahead.
No, you've...
I just want to say, we haven't talked about health care costs here, and there is such a conversation going on now in Washington about the future of the Affordable Care Act, and a component part of that was doing something to address costs. Overlay that with us on retirement and sort of the role that escalating health care costs have had.
So, I mean, you're really going back to the big picture. Why are we in such trouble? We're in such trouble because our needs for retirement income are increasing, and they're increasing because we're living longer, and because we have high and rapidly rising health care costs. There's also this fact we have very low interest rates, so you need a bigger pile. At the same time that needs are increasing, resources
All
are
right.
declining.
I have one more question, and
yes.
we'll let you go
yes.
on with your day. Those of us in the real world have tuition bills to pay unless yeah. we can play hockey for Jerry York at Boston College. And those of us in the real world dip into our retirement accounts to write tuition checks to esteemed schools. Should we stop that? Should we sacrifice our kids' education and fix the racket instead of dipping into our future retirement?
I think it's a little bit like the notification in the airplane. Put the mask on yourself first and then put it on your child. So I think protecting retirement income is really important. But also these tuition numbers, I am a professor, are really out of sight. And even the public universities are very expensive. And I don't see how right. any middle income person can make it.
We would be pleased for you to attend our New York studios
yeah, please,
if you
yeah.
ever darken. If you ever come to New York City, and of course, Alicia Monell at Boston College. I can't say enough, folks, about the Center for Retirement Research. You'll look at 12 papers there. You'll see six. You'll go, yeah, I really don't want to read that. So you'll see two or three more that are like, yeah, maybe. And there will be one on your topic, your emotion, that will hit you over the head. Alicia Monell, Drucker Professor, Boston College.
Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, member SIPC.
Bill Gross will be along, as always, on Jobs Day, but we have a mystery guest, David Gurra, in New York.
Mystery guest in New York as we push ahead to the jobs numbers at 8:30 Wall Street time, 8:30 Storrow Drive time. Let's say today
like
while you're in Boston. Jim Glassman joins us now in studio. He's the head economist at Chase Commercial Bank, and as you said, joins us here in New York. Jim, let me ask you, first of all, here we had this big diminishment the last time we got one of these reports, from 4.9% to 4.6%, steeper drop than many would have expected. In light of that, do you expect the rate to stay the same, to tick up a little bit? What are you looking for in today's numbers?
You know, it may tick up a slight bit, but usually when these things happen and the unemployment rate takes a big step down, you tend to stay there for a little while as things catch up to it. So often the aberration that you see in the unemployment rate isn't volatility that gets reversed. It really just kind of is a step down, and then we kind of hover there for a while. But, you know, I think we're kind of in the zone where we should be for the measured unemployed. There still is a pool of people who are not captured in this unemployment rate. They will be coming in, and I expect that that will probably slow the decline in unemployment. We probably will hover here for a while.
How useful are the numbers that we got yesterday, the weekly numbers, the ADP numbers? I was struck by who's hiring. You're seeing big companies doing more of the hiring than smaller companies right now.
Yeah, that does make sense. It's kind of hard to know where we are right now because there's a lot up in the air with the outlook for this coming year. If we get new push from Washington, it may sort of rev things up a little bit more. But I think we were probably heading toward something more moderate growth and job growth because, frankly, we look at the unemployment measures, we're sort of getting there. We've got maybe 2 million young people still out. They will be coming back in. And we've got we still have about 1 million people more than normal who are working part-time and they want a full-time job. But honestly, I think it's not surprising that we're seeing the steady job growth. When the economy starts doing better, the large companies probably offer more stability for people. And so, you know, if they're hiring, then they tend to draw people more than, say, small businesses. But a lot will depend on it and what they do on the policy side. If they help the small business community, that may change the story a bit. Hmm.
Jim, what are you learning about the youth of America? You were front and center during the crisis on what the different age partitions, if you will, we're doing in America. What is your latest research on our kids? Are they going back to work?
Slowly coming back. The last couple of months was kind of a step back on this, but it looked like all of 2016 we were seeing this steady pullback. And if you talk to people in higher education, they would say they would tell you that enrollments are coming down. And they expected that because when the economy does better, enrollments go down. So I think you look at the 20 and 30-year-olds as a group, there are about 2 million still who have not come back in. Maybe they're still doing the schooling. I think this generation got more help than maybe you and I did, Tom, because parents are available to help if, you know, you can go back to school. And so a lot of kids did that. And they were smart to do it because the nature of the jobs are more demanding, and there are good jobs out there if you can get better trained. So I think we're seeing a reversal of this thing that's been going on. We had about 3 million people who dropped out originally. Now it's down to about 2 million. So that tells me we are starting to see improvement.
Right.
Look at the participation rate of various ages. You see some improvement there.
Is our pay raise for 2017 going to be a benefit pay raise, or will we actually see something in our check?
I hope we see it in our check. It's hard to tell from these monthly numbers because they're all over the map. The average hourly earnings on a year-on-year basis, which should be smooth, is sort of vacillating between 2.5% and 3.5%. So I bet as the year progresses, we're going to see more real money showing up in the paycheck. You'll see it.
I'm struck by the transition that we've seen underway here, away from blue-collar jobs, away from manufacturing jobs, into service, into retail, the growth of pink-collar jobs, I've seen them called before. How seismic a change is this, as you see it?
You know, it's been going on for a while, right? Because, I mean, this is really one of the disruptions going on in the industrial economy is we used to have 20 million people working in manufacturing. Now that's down to 12 million. So 8 million jobs in manufacturing have disappeared. And this is a secular trend that's been going on as a result of innovation. So I don't know that it's a step change, but it is, you know, it's something that you expect in a modern economy.
Let's get a 2017 update. Folks, if you're just joining us, Jim Glassman, J.P. Morgan with us. Generous of him almost every month, unless he's on the road with us to preview Jobs Day. Jim Glassman, give us an update on the nostalgia that we saw from your professor, Robert Gordon of Northwestern, last year. Has Mr. Trump pulled us away from a nostalgic look back? Are we beginning to look forward?
You know, the market seems to be acting that way, right? You had the election. The market is anticipating we're going to get a new effort to try to push the economy more. The equity market tends to monetize hopes, and so in a way we're bringing that forward. I think maybe so. I think, you know, taking a time out, looking at regulations, trying to fix the healthcare thing. I wish it's not really a partisan issue. We really need to fix the healthcare issue because that's our number one imbalance that's plaguing the economy. But I think the hope of tax reform, tax reduction, some rethinking of the regulations is bringing back that enthusiasm and animal spirits, frankly. And I think that's part of what's driving the equity market.
Well, but an animal spirits is a nominal GDP. If we do get Trumpflation, is it a good pickup in nominal GDP? Will there be a real growth pickup?
That's
or
the
will
question.
It all be within inflation?
That's the question. A lot of people think, look, the economy is close to full employment. Our demographics is slowed. How much can we really get out of real economic activity if we try to step on the gas? Personally, I think what we're going to find out, I'm not so skeptical. I think we've got a lot of capacity out there. The businesses have a lot of capacity to do more and boost productivity. We just haven't seen that in our numbers. And the reason I say that is because when you look everywhere, innovation's everywhere. And companies are driving really hard to be more efficient, cut costs. So I think that we're going to find out that we have the capacity to do better, to grow more. And it will translate into more real benefits, not so much inflation.
We had a conversation a little earlier in the week about the squishiness of the term productivity.
Yeah.
What does it mean? What does it mean to you when we talk about an improvement in productivity? What exactly does that look like?
You know, it requires intuition to think about this. You don't see it in numbers are very poor at trying to capture this thing because sometimes it takes a decade to see a trend developing. It means that we're being more efficient at doing things. We've got less downtime in our workday. I mean, I look at your own personal life. Mm. I have less wasted time in my life because of the, you know, online shopping, because of what I can do, seamless, remote connecting. And I think that's going on all over the place, not only in our business community, but in our private life. So to me, it's really more of a feeling. Are we getting more? Are we able to do more with the same resources? I think a lot of what's going on in our economy is helping us to do that, including the sharing economy.
James Glassman here with us in the studio, head economist at Chase Commercial Bank. Great to have you here. As we continue to press on to 8:30 when the jobs data come out, there's been so much conversation about what the president-elect may or may not do in concert with Republicans on Capitol Hill. A big component of that is the prospect for infrastructure spending. I wonder, as you look at that, as you think about that, what would make a stimulus package the most efficacious? In other words, what are lawmakers wrestling with? How do they make this thing something that actually does make a difference if, in fact, they go down that path?
I personally think what really does make a difference is tax reform and action on the tax side, because I think that changes the attitude, the confidence level of the business community. Infrastructure spending, there are limits on how much you can do because it takes time to get all the permitting done, as President Obama showed. These shovel-ready projects, they have to go through a long process before they get put in place. And I think Congress is probably going to be trying to figure out how to pay for this because we do have a long-term fiscal challenge. So to me, the greater potential here is what we might get on the tax reform side, particularly in the corporate area.
In the corporate area, there's been talk of a repatriation holiday, some concern about what corporations might do with that money if they were able to bring it back at a lower rate. On the subject of efficaciousness here, are you optimistic that that would be spent well?
Well, you know, I don't think that's really what drives business investment decisions. If you've got a good market here, you're going to be investing here regardless of where the money is parked. So I think the thing that makes the tax reform most efficacious is if the repatriation part is put together with a broader tax reform, bring the corporate tax rates down, 100% expensing, those kinds of things, limit, cap the burden for small businesses. That's really a big deal. I think that's the kind of thing that really generates the animal spirits, which I think the market's been hinting at.
I want to rip up the script here, Jim Glassman. We just had the great honor of speaking with Alicia Monell of Boston College, truly one of America's giants of thinking on our failed retirement systems. Just looking at her update on 401ks nationwide, it's just stunning the failure of the system for so many Americans. How linked is our retirement success to buoyant GDP growth? To me, it almost has to be the key linkage, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one linkage, and the other is the whole healthcare area. I mean, Part of the issue with the retirement system or the public side is that we don't have our retirement age linked up to our life expectancy. So the program's always getting out of balance because, thank God, we all tend to live longer over time. But I think it's important You know, you could argue, well, look, Americans don't seem to be really hung up about this because our saving is very low. Look, compare us with Japan. Japanese save very high rates because they don't really have that safety system. So I think it would help, though. I think the more secure people feel about the future, the more confidence you have about what you're doing. So it's an important part of the public sector income support programs.
On the subject of healthcare, a lot of conversation on Capitol Hill about what happens next to Obamacare, if Obamacare remains around. I imagine that that law has had implications, huge implications on the labor market here, and the prospect of repealing it could really throw things in a different direction.
Well, yeah, the problem is that insurance premiums rising, small businesses face a real big burden here. The system wasn't – we've got people into the system over the last 8 years that are relatively unhealthy, but all the young, healthy folks don't come in. So it's creating stresses in the system. I really think the bigger issue is not so much coverage, but getting people more engaged in the process of choosing their own health care. Making people think about things, making people understand what the costs are, and helping doctors figure that out, getting a little more competition. What's really missing in our healthcare system is we're not managing the resources very well. And if you believe the Congressional Budget Office projections, what they're telling us is if we don't do anything, healthcare is going to be gobbling up an awful lot of resources in the future. Partly because the demographics is shifting, but partly because we don't really get people engaged in the process of figuring out better ways to do things.
I wonder about the kind of jobs being created versus the kind of jobs that are disappearing. Is it even? Are the jobs that are going away being replaced with jobs of the same kind?
Well, if you look at the longer trend, the jobs that are disappearing are a lot of manufacturing jobs. They were paying above average. So that's really part of the problem. People are finding jobs, but the pay is not the same that they were getting before. And I think that's why there's such a divide. That's why there's so much unhappiness in the industrial economy. But, you know, the truth is, new jobs, if you think about it, when a company hires somebody, that first job you get is not your best-paying job in your career, you hope.
Still with us, James Glassman, head economist at Chase Commercial Bank. Coming up in a few moments, Bill Gross of Janus Capital will join us. Jim, let me get your reaction here. Yep. To the headline. Remember, we talked about the fact that it might go up slightly. The survey was for 4.7%. Indeed, that is what we got here. And then the change in payrolls here down to 144,000. Your reaction, if you would.
Yeah, I think this is good news, actually. It tells you we're sort of hovering in the zone of close to full employment, not really there yet. And yet, we're starting to see now more and more signs that that is actually helping workers because we're seeing average hourly earnings jumped 2.9% on a year-on-year basis. So we've been volatile here. The average hourly earnings wage gains running from 2.5% to 3.5%. We're sort of in that 3% zone now, which is pretty good news because that means we've kind of broken out of that 2% rut that we were in for much of this recovery. So I would say this is kind of the story we're going to see more and more in the coming year. The economy's, you know, job growth is going to be slowing down gradually and wages start to do better. And hopefully unemployment stays in this zone as we bring the rest of the folks who are missing back into the job market. So I'd say good news.
Let me ask you here just about the way that the Federal Reserve policymakers are going to read these data. I wonder if you had a threshold, a number over which this would have to come in for them to be satisfied to move a pace with the rate timetable, the rate raise timetable that they set out at the last meeting, the expectation here of 3 rate increases in the year 2017. Are they going to be satisfied with what they see today?
I think this is exactly the kind of news that makes them comfortable getting rates slowly back to something more normal. There would be no issue if the Fed funds rate were not so low, but they think that a normal Fed funds rate is closer to about 3%, and they want to get there in an orderly way. So they're starting to see more and more signs that the U.S. economy is doing well. We got our job market getting back to full employment, not quite there yet. It probably over the next couple of years will be. So I think this is exactly the kind of report that plays into their expectation, makes the case for slowly moving the Fed funds rate back to something more normal.
Very quickly here, Jim Glass, about 30 seconds left. I'm looking at the underemployment rate. That is at 9.2%. Now it was at 9.3%, ticking down slightly. How big a concern is underemployment to you here still when you look at the U.S. labor market?
It's a concern, but it's been improving. And I think it's another way of saying we're not quite there yet. We still have hidden populations of unemployment And I think as the job market stays here and does well, we're going to see more and more of that come down. So my expectation is we'll see a lot of the damage that was done during the recession. Unemployment that's not captured in the unemployment rate will slowly creep its way back. And I think it's that aspect that's going to be the most interesting in these job reports
All
to
right.
follow.
Jim Glassman, their head economist at Chase Commercial Bank. Thank you very much for your time. Again, the unemployment numbers here at 144,000 when you look at private payrolls. I want to welcome our listeners, our viewers around the world on Bloomberg Television. David Gura and Tom Keene here, now joined by Bill Gross of Janus Capital. Bill, great to speak with you as always. And let's start by taking stock here. President Obama, in the last 2 weeks of his second term as president of the United States, he has been touting his achievements with regard to the labor market here in a memo yesterday, in speeches over the last few weeks. Give us your assessment of how the labor market looks today, how the labor market post-crisis looks under the tenure of President Obama.
Well, he's done a fine job from where he started, right, 8 years ago, and down at 4.7% unemployment from, as I remember, something above 9 and close to 10. So, the economy's improving, the labor market's improving. I still think, in contrast to what Jim Glassman just said, that the U6, the underemployment rate is relatively high and needs to come down by 1 or 2%, because there we're talking about the labor force that wants to work as opposed to the U3 number. But it's a decent number, and it suggests that GDP perhaps is moving along at 2% or 2.5%. I think that in order to to get a very healthy economy, a Trump suggested strong economy, that you need 3% real growth and you need 5% nominal growth, and we're about a point under for both of those.
Well, but Bill, this is absolutely crucial. If we are to see a lift in the animal spirits, certainly something the president-elect wants, do you tilt towards it will be an inflation lift, illusory to Americans of little value, or will we actually see real economic growth over the next year or 2 years?
Yeah, I think some of both, Tom. It's hard to know. We don't really know what the program will be. Trump is suggesting a $1 trillion program over 10 years. That's $100 billion a year. That's a 0.5% in terms of fiscal spending that might boost real growth by 0.5% or so. Mm-hmm. We've seen inflation with these numbers and wages go up by close to 3%. So I think some of both. I think what's critical, however, is the productivity number, and not just productivity, but total factor productivity. It gets a little complicated in, economists speak. But what that means is that you can't just throw resources at the economy like Trump may do and the Republican administration may do in terms of fiscal spending, but you need to throw productivity at the economy. In other words, resources that produce growing productivity as opposed to just more resources. And so we're going to have to see about that. That, I think, is the crucial number.
Bill, it is such an interesting time, and it's a time where we could do a six-hour interview with you. Maybe we'll do that if my people talk to your people. But the basic idea here, Bill, is there's three vectors to interest rates. There's a Trump reflation, there's a jump condition that we've had since November 8th, and a stability. And then there's a lot of people talking about, okay, this is great, but we're going to roll over to a new lower rate regime, some of that because of international affairs. What is the Janus Unconstrained Fund betting on? Higher rates, sustained rates, or do we roll back to a pre-Trump level?
Well, slightly higher rates, and here I'll introduce a new factor that I know you're interested in because you're a technician to a considerable extent, but there's been a 30-year, 35-year trend line since 1984, 83 on the 10-year. Take the 10-year Treasury, for instance, moving down perhaps by 30 basis points a year, but the downward trend line being hit by 6, 7, 8, 9 times in a cyclical type of fashion, a very strong trend line. You know, at the moment, that trend line is around 2.6%. And so I would say this, it's hard to know what fiscal spending will do in terms of real growth and in terms of inflation. It's hard to know what other countries and central banks will do in terms of their quantitative easing, et cetera, et cetera. But we will see it. We will know it. You know, if the 10-year breaks 2.6% on a weekly or on a monthly basis, because it's so strong and so important in terms of technical analysis, yeah, that if and when it's broken on the upside, it's a bear market.
Right.
And if it's not broken on the upside, we just sort of stay where we are.
Right. And David Gura, this is really, really important, this idea of trying to find a point estimate of where things change. Mr. Gross says 2.6%. There's a lot of other opinions on that, but it's nice at least to hear a point estimate we can get our hands around.
Absolutely. Bill, let me ask you, if we're starting to see a recalibration of expectations when it comes to Washington's ability to affect policy. We had the excitement, the exuberance in the markets at the end of last year. Here we are in 2017. We see Republican lawmakers especially laying out their agenda items. Is there going to be a healthy dose of realism here over these next few weeks?
Well, I think there should be. We don't know what the fiscal package will be, and it will be having its effect a year or 2 years from now. We don't know what the health care reconfiguration will be. We're not sure exactly where the money goes and where it comes from. So I think there's a touch of realism. Again, what I think investors want to see is a standard 3% real growth rate, which will induce, you know, profit growth. With wages moving up at 3%, it's important that real growth moves up by 3% so that corporate profits can participate in that particular run. So we're going to need those types of numbers. At the moment, what do we have? 1.9% for the last 12 months, about 2% for the last 5 years. Can Trump do it? Can he produce a 3% number and give some to profits and some to wages? We're just going to have to see. I tend to be skeptical. I tend to be of the, you know, secular stagnation, Robert Gordon, low hanging fruit, productivity, new normal type of persuasion. But we'll see if fiscal spending can get us up there.
We continue our conversation with William Gross. Bill Gross, everyone wants to know what you feel about Trump economics, Trump theory, but particularly that through the prism that we heard earlier this week from Lawrence Summer, the former Secretary of Treasury. Larry Summers was fiery about speaking about the voodoo economics of a selected group of Trump advisors, even calling it economic creationism. Is Trump economics on solid theoretical ground?
Well, on a short-term basis, perhaps, but I think that's what Larry Summers is talking about, creationism, a little sensitive, I guess, but voodoo economics, we know about that. Well, what he's suggesting, basically, is that some of the policy initiatives, the tax cuts, for instance, that will generate more revenue. We've heard this before. We've seen it with the Laffer curve, and so he's criticizing that. He's also talking about repatriation of money, you know, $1 trillion, $2 trillion coming back into the economy and regenerating investment. Typically and historically, back in the early part of this century,
right,
about 15 years ago with Bush, it did come back. They did reduce the rate, but it came back and it was used for stock buybacks and for mergers and acquisitions, not for investment. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of voodoo there in terms of the tax policies, at least, not necessarily in terms of the fiscal spending.
Bill, this is an important question. I believe you worked at a small startup shop in Newport Beach a few years ago, and you had enormous influence with other nations' debt. You knew about Mexico debt, you knew about Poland debt, you knew about the debt of Asia and the modest amount of debt in Asia. Are you concerned that Trump economics will lead to a zero-sum world that will destabilize the international financial system?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. Let's not put odds on it and go to an extreme. But yeah, it's a possibility because the world in total, and we're talking about emerging and we're talking about developed with Japan and so on, is at 350% of debt to GDP, the highest it's ever been. What does that mean? Why is that such a negative? Well, in certain countries' terms, in terms of Mexico and some of the emerging market countries, to the extent that they have a high amount and a growing amount of dollar-denominated debt, and the dollar strengthens, which it has, except for the last few days, as you know, then the ability to pay back that dollar-denominated debt down the road becomes more and more difficult and could potentially, create a situation where certain countries have to be bailed out by the IMF and so on. I'm not suggesting that for Mexico. I like Mexico, but yes, it's a definite problem whenever you get imbalances in terms of debt. Look for debt to GDP, and therein lies the problem. China is a good example going forward.
Bill, there are plenty of people here who would like to see you on Twitter, and this may be the president-elect who gets you to do it. I'm sure you've been following what the president-elect has been tweeting this week. He's been talking about companies in specific and talking about the relationship with Mexico, as well as we sort of try to navigate all of this uncertainty. Are we getting the contours here of a trade policy from what we've seen from Donald Trump this week?
Well, we're about to get perhaps, or we're getting what we're seeing in terms of tweets. I think it's interesting, David, that you know, some of these pre-term policies, he's not in office yet, where he's basically cajoling, if that's a nice word, you know, companies to move production back in the United States. I think that's fine, but it reminds me to some extent, does it not, of policies in Italy long ago, you know, associated with Mussolini and government control of corporate interests. And so, you know, I don't want it to go too far. Let's.
Okay, but Bill, come on. Mr. Gross, I have to interrupt there. This is too important. Are you suggesting that we are seeing a fascism light or some form of new neo-fascism with the policies of our president-elect?
Well, I'm not going to go that far. That's your term. I was going to put out a tweet and say, none dare call it fascism, and so I don't dare call it fascism. But to the extent that he pinpoints certain corporations and certain industries and makes them change their policies, you know, based upon statements and threats, you know, it reminds me, yes, of policies long ago, which, by the way, were supposed to make the trains run on time and did for a few years, but ultimately the trains weren't running.
Bill, let me ask you here about the role of the Fed Reserve here in the new term with Donald Trump as president. I wonder if we're seeing a third mandate here. We've got employment, we've got inflation, then we've got the Fed's job to be a political punching bag. We have the prospects here for a radical transformation of the Fed. Five new people could be joining the Fed, including a chairperson here in the next 18 months. Who would you like to see running? What kind of person would you like to see running the Fed? How do you see the Fed changing here under a president, Donald Trump?
Well, as you probably know, and I know Tom knows for sure over the past year or two, you know, my favorite policy in terms of the Fed, the central bank, is to move interest rates back as close to normal as possible without threatening the economy in terms of high real rates. The critical question, of course, is what's the appropriate real neutral rate or nominal neutral rate that'll make the economy chug along at 2 to 3%. I would like to see a Fed that is more interested in raising rates and producing a neutral interest rate, because I think ultimately the last several years has been destructive in terms of where they've been at negative interest rates, not in the United States, but negative interest rates around the world, you know, basically have been robbing savers of their ability to save, which has robbed investment of an ability to grow in terms of economic terms. So I would want to use the Fed and the U.S. as a leader to raise interest rates back to more normal levels,
right,
in order to regenerate savings.
Bill, we have so much more to talk about this morning, and time is just short. Help me here with the theme that we've had this week of the butterfly effect of EM currencies, which have a certain curve and an acceleration to their weakness. How do you position and how do you think about profoundly weak Malaysian, profoundly weak Turkish, the Mexican peso breaching into record weakness as well? What should that signal to the new administration?
Well, those are all different situations, right? Turkey is a basket case from a number of angles. But let's pick on Mexico for a second. And yes, every time Trump tweets about a car company and moving production back, you know, the peso weakens. I would look at a longer-term trend line in terms of the real peso, inflation adjusted, and point out that it's perhaps 45 to 50% lower than it was 5 or 6 years ago. What does that mean? It means the peso is very competitive. It means that, yes, even if, you know, some of that production doesn't flow to Mexico on a political basis, that it's very, very, very cheap, you know, relative to other countries. And so that's my way of saying that the peso is very cheap and it's politically oriented. And the trick for an investor is basically to try and time that political influence and to buy a very cheap currency at a very attractive level.
Are you prepared to start writing the obituary for globalization, Bill? We've heard people saying that we're seeing the end of it. Are you in that camp?
Yeah, I think so. And I wrote the obituary in mild terms with the new normal back in 2008 and 2009. I mean, we've had several longer-term secular trends. We've had Bretton Woods in 1971. We've moved into another globalization type of trend, which induced a monetary consideration. And now we're moving in the other direction, if only from monetary terms, that we've gone so low that negative interest rates have to move higher.
Right.
And of course, with trade policies and all of that reflecting a deglobalization as opposed to a globalization. Yeah. So yeah, I think we're in a new era, and I think some of the effects are going to be negative.
I want David Gura to take us out here, but Bill Gross, I got one more question. Should we build a wall around the San Francisco 49ers to keep them removed from the rest of the NFL?
Well, maybe the Browns. Give the Niners a chance. They've got the second draft choice. Who knows? Let's go with that.
Very good.
Bill Gross there of Janus Capital joining us, as he often does here on JobSec. Grateful for his time.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, member SIPC.